broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
The story of human progress is truly heroic. It goes something like this. We are born into a pitiless universe, facing steep odds against life-enabling order, and in constant jeopardy of falling apart. We were shaped by a force that is ruthlessly competitive. We are made from crooked timber, vulnerable to illusion, self-centeredness, and at times astounding stupidity. Yet human nature has also been blessed with resources that open a space for a kind of redemption. We are endowed with the power to combine ideas recursively, to have thoughts about our thoughts. We have an instinct for language, allowing us to share the fruits of our experiences and ingenuity. We are deepened with the capacity for sympathy, for pity, imagination, compassion, commiseration. This historic story is not just another myth. Myths are fictions. But this one is true. True to the best of our knowledge, which is the only truth we have. We believe it because we have reasons to believe it. As we learn more, we can show which parts of the story continue to be true and which ones false, as any of them might be and any could become. And the story belongs not to any tribe, but to all humanity, to any sentient creature with the power to reason and the urge to persist in its being. For it requires only the convictions that life is better than death, health is better than sickness, abundance is better than want. Freedom is better than coercion. Happiness is better than suffering. And knowledge is better than superstition and ignorance. Steven Pinker, in his new book, Enlightenment Now. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Today, we're considering the second in our series of discussions on free speech. In the first session, a few months ago, we talked about free speech on college campuses. And later this summer, we'll talk about free speech and the internet. Today, however, we'll consider free speech and civil society, or free speech in the broader community. My guests are Don Rush, Associate Program Director, Senior Producer of News and Public Affairs at Delmarva Public Radio, and Adam Wood, Chairman of the Department of English at Salisbury University and Chair of the Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure. Welcome both of you to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Let me turn to you first, Don. What is free speech, and why is it so central to our democracy? And in fact, I would suggest to our nature as human beings.
Well, free speech, particularly in Western societies, obviously grows out of the Enlightenment. I mean, it reaches back as far as, say, John Milton in the 17th century, who talked about an explicit defense of free speech and freedom from prior restraint, which echoes down even to this day. Now, the state, of course, retains that ability to regulate scandalous writings. And let's be very clear, Milton didn't want to tolerate the Catholic Church. So he was not completely free and open. John Locke probably sets the foundation, though, for free speech in the sense that free speech is important for people and men and women to govern themselves. That's the idea as a moving away from, say, for instance, the rule of divine right. So that you have a situation where if you're going to establish a government, a democracy, a representative government, you have to allow free speech to then have an interaction between various citizens to then come up with the appropriate solutions. It was also, Locke also thought about in terms of a positive force then in this discussion, that people could come together in a cooperative effort. This is contrast to, say, Thomas Hobbes, who talked about the Leviathan and fear. And, of course, John Stuart Mill, 19th century, lays much of the basis, really, for what we think of as the First Amendment, which is a positive expression of opinions, even those that we don't happen to agree with or find offensive. Two quotes that struck me as being perhaps relevant to today. One is by John Locke, in which he says, "Fear is a mortal enemy of reasoned judgment and therefore the most profound ally of tyranny." And John Stuart Mill wrote, "The chief threat to democracies is not the state, but the social tyranny of one's fellow citizens," end quote. And when you think about what's happening today, both in terms of fear and in terms of not the state imposing its force upon you, but other people, social movements enforcing themselves upon you, that it almost brings it really into the 21st century.
Don, say something a little bit more, and then maybe Adam can chime in here. Explain a little bit more about what you mean by social tyranny. I think that's an incredibly important concept in terms of free speech.
Well, even the founding fathers actually were very concerned about the tyranny of the majority. That's why they created various sets of levels in terms of government. They didn't necessarily trust the mass of people. Hamilton is a good example of that. So they created various structures, including the Electoral College, for example, to weed out those people who may not be qualified or not be fit to be president of the United States, that perhaps the people themselves would then go and elect. So there's already built in this idea that there are social forces that we have to contain in some fashion, that there has to be what may be called ordered liberty. When you move to the 21st century, what you see is, particularly in social media, you can find either internet mobs in which somebody says something and suddenly they are descended upon by various people denouncing them, sometimes stalking them on the websites, so that you get these social forces that are colliding with one another and that can impinge upon your own ability to, say, express yourself.
Adam? I think Don really set this all up sort of very clearly, and I think just to sort of add on to the notion of the sort of social tyranny, that this is, you know, really when we see the main threat to free speech, that certain groups believe that they have the right to either limit certain kinds of speech or to compel certain kinds of speech. And again, this sort of shifts throughout different historical moments of what is trying to be limited or things like that. But it's tends to sort of emerge out of that. We see it move into full tyranny, of course, when the government begins to endorse one position on speech or a certain kind of speech or another. One other thing I would sort of add is another great quote from John Stuart Mill, you know, his essay on liberty that is very often sort of cited as one of the central documents for this, where he says, "If any opinion is compelled to silence, that opinion may, for aught we can certainly know, be true. To deny this is to assume our own infallibility." And so, you know, one of the real issues, I think, sort of going on here is a notion of, someone believes that they know best, that they know what the truth is, and that opinions that go against that should be sort of radically limited, should be compelled to silence. We see this sort of going on now with the idea of no platforming, right? Of just simply denying certain speakers a right to speak or keeping them from speaking at those sort of settings. And again, this changes, you know, to the left and to the right as history moves on. But it seems in a lot of ways grounded on the same issue of what we believe to be true in many ways and limiting those who seem to disagree with us.
For me, I think of free speech in a very broad sense, in the sense of free speech is clearly the freedom of expression, but it's also the freedom to have ideas, particular kinds of ideas, and express those ideas. So it opens up in your mind the ability to think about different kinds of concepts, different kinds of ideas, and then to express those ideas. I guess from a psychological point of view, Fred, I'm thinking of mental liberation, in a sense, to think what, in fact, you want to think now as well. And I see a relationship between that kind of psychological sense and social tyranny as well. So say something about the interplay.
Yeah, I mean, I think limitations on free speech always inevitably lead to the notion of thought crimes, right? That even having a thought that is contrary to popular belief or dominant belief, whatever it is, becomes the sort of fundamental issue. And so I think, you know, this often leads to a certain form of self-censorship, that certain people feel uncomfortable expressing their beliefs in certain settings. I think, you know, the great novel 1984 sort of really sets this up, where at a certain point, you know, the social tyranny becomes so internalized that individuals become afraid to even think certain things. And when we limit ourselves in our capacity for thought, we limit ourselves in our capacity for inquiry and our capacity to sort of move things forward, but also to counter bad thoughts in some ways, to counter bad ideas. I always think of the example of Galileo, right, who was in essence punished for free speech issues, who said, no, the sun doesn't move around the earth. It's the other way around. And the very notion that he could say that was seen as blasphemy. And so, again, I think, you know, a number of the sort of early free speech issues, and we still see this today, are also connected to issues about religion, that some people feel that it is wrong to criticize religion. And so we think about how a number of atheists are really attacked in terms of issues of free speech.
As a matter of fact, we have, and I think in this day and age, I think the polarization process, I think, is probably brought this, I think, to greater light than ever before, in which people are so polarized for whatever reasons that they are come to the point where they do not want to say, for instance, even hear about somebody talking about being a Democrat or Republican. I ran across that just the other day. In which somebody didn't want to do a job because there was a bunch of Democrats and they didn't want to be around them, right? So I think polarization in a society, I think, really begins to emphasize this inability to talk to one another and to inevitably, of course, also to shut down the speech of someone else that you don't want to hear their ideas from. And it's more than just an individual thing in which you say, oh, well, I want to hear this, or I want to go to one thing in one event or another. It's a whole social phenomena that takes place. So I think that polarization, I think, is important. The other thing, too, I think, is that society is going through a really tumultuous time. And it stretches back, I think, particularly to the cultural explosion of the 1960s, in which, for the most part, you know, prior to that, white society pretty much dominated the country and put everybody else in their place. After the 1960s, all these various groups identified by the white majority, began to express themselves. And in that conflict, you get people who say, well, you don't know what it's like to have my experience.
Right.
So and to some extent, and that's true.
Certainly.
And we see that even echo to this day. So I think the other piece of the puzzle, if we're to look at today's society, is this kind of fracturing of society, because society is now no longer this sort of monolithic society in which there is a one particular group that is dominant, but rather now you see the emergence of a whole whole bunch of groups, many of whom have been discriminated against or felt oppression of some kind or another. And it's only probably going to continue in that fashion as we move towards the great demographic change of, say, about 2050, I guess it is, in which whites will become a minority. And there will be greater representation of minorities, at least what was viewed as traditional minorities. So I think that fracturing also begins to emphasize this kind of I don't want to hear you, or I'm going to shout you down. And one can debate, by the way, and time, place, and manner when in terms of protests and so on, because I would argue that protests and boycotts are all part of free speech. And that in the case of, for instance, there's a set of protesters who say, who come and they want to say yell, for instance, in an academic function, right? The administration certainly has the right to say, okay, we got to remove these people because it's time, place, and manner. On the other hand, civil disobedience has a great tradition within the society. So
of course
they've been noticed, then they're moved out, and the event, for instance, goes on. There have been a number of those kinds of things. Boycotts, that's all part of free speech. So when people, for instance, students say, I don't want Speaker X, and they go and they protest, and they apply pressure, that's all part of that interconnection process by which I think free speech is so fundamental. So it works both ways. It's not only just that you have a platform, but you also have a right under free speech to oppose that platform, to boycott, even to disrupt it for a moment or two, you know, depending upon what the situation is. Time, place, and manner then, of course, imposes itself, and you can move those folks out. But that's all part of that free speech process, I think.
No, I mean, I think you're right. It's an interesting, very fine line in terms of exercising one's right to protest, as you're right, as an expression of free speech, you know, to make one's voice heard in opposition to a speaker or a thinker that they don't like is one thing. It's sort of another thing when that sort of protest continues to where that speaker or thinker's voice is never actually heard in the debate. And certain arguments say, well, we've heard it before. We've heard these arguments before, so we don't need to hear them again. And so, again, there is always that very tricky sort of gray area in between what is what we might call sort of a legitimate protest as opposed to the full-on no-platforming movement that we start to see at times.
I would only just suggest this, particularly in terms of the academics, academic space. The problem, I think, in part of for the university is that the university is not a safe space.
Right.
It's not a safe space for necessarily for exchange of ideas. That the society itself and its conflicts then flood into that space. The most dramatic period certainly was the 1960s with the anti-war movement, which literally took over university buildings.
Right.
So one can talk about the sort of ideal ivory tower kind of discussion that takes place, right? On the other hand, you have to understand that outside, you know, at the windows, you can see the turbulence that's taking place, and it is eventually going to come crashing into your safe space of academic freedom and so on. And I would also suggest, by the way, that in terms of speakers coming and going, that sort of thing, if a university, if the only place to express your ideas was as a part of a university, that, you know, that would be one thing. But
right.
The fact of the matter is that these ideas are disseminated in all kinds of different ways. And then it becomes rather, instead of free speech issues, it becomes policy. Well, what do we want? So, for example, would you, for instance, a university, would you say, for instance, invite a Klan member?
Right.
And so, okay, well, that's a policy decision.
Right.
Right, and universities also have certain values that they want to express that they hold to be the case, not just every idea, right, that's put out there. So I think, and in that mix, you constantly get this turbulence that's going on. So we're trying to figure out, you know, well, what's the right way to do this, the right way to do that, and you can oppose. I mean, you can oppose, you know, protests and so on and so forth, because you have the free right to think that and to express it and to say that. And I think that's important to preserve.
No, I mean, I think you're right. And it's interesting that we think about the 1960s and student protests on campus. And we talked about this somewhat on the last show. But that we are really starting to see a certain rise in that, right? There are certainly debates about whether the issue about students protesting on campuses about speakers is overblown or underreported, and you know, there's not really
right.
been any hardcore research yet that seems to really show it. But we really are sort of seeing that. I think one of the sort of differences between the 60s and now, though, is that in the 60s, it seemed much more that students and minority groups, as you'd mentioned, were protesting for their voices to be heard in contradistinction to the dominant white cultural voice, where the protests now very often on college campuses seem to be about sort of limiting certain kinds of voices. Grounded in perhaps the same impulse towards a broadening of culture and certain social justice notions, but sort of approaching it from the other side of the fence. I mean, it's strange that in the 60s, most of the or a lot of the defenders of free speech were coming up more on the left, where a lot of the times some of the speakers who are most virulently in favor of free speech are now coming up on sort of the far right. And so it's a continuation of the conversation, but in some ways it seems that the polls have begun to shift a bit.
Hey, I don't only make the observation that I think that that represents the shifting, changing values and mores of the country as a whole. For right. example, if you had a speaker, for instance, who, say, opposed gay marriage, for example, well, the shift has been so dramatic that their views are now – now in a minority as opposed to they used to be in a majority. So you keep, so I think one of the things that's happening is you get this this constant churning in which you get a shift in where the country is going. I would say, by the way, in terms of identity politics and so on, but the thing you got to keep in mind is that you know, white identity politics, particularly as a practice up through the 1960s, and the most best representative, of course, is Southern strategy of the Republican Party. That it's still part of our culture, and that right. we're still finding groups, minority groups particularly, still banging up against that particular issue.
Of course.
And you saw, for instance, some of the reaction to, say, President Obama's election. And while not all people who opposed his presidency involved the issue of race, it certainly was there.
Of course.
So even though it was now not a majority anymore or not dominant, as, say, for instance, it might have been in the 1950s, you still get that underlying restriction in terms. So I think we're still seeing that struggle.
Right.
That takes place.
No, I agree. Yeah.
Let me come back to the Enlightenment, if I can. And the Enlightenment was kind of you hit on Adam. It was more the identification of the individual and the ability of the individual now to be recognized as an important and significant entity, with the whole concept of reason that everybody could reason, or as Pinker said in this opening comment I read, we're endowed with the power to combine ideas recursively and to have thoughts about our thoughts. So we can contemplate, we can create mentally. And this was sort of an identification of the individual now. The state does not have to do this for you. The king does not have to do this. The church does not have to do this for you, but the whole sense that you can now reason on your own. And I was one of those, not in college, but I was one of those protesters in the 1960s. The civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and I was in the streets. And my sense here is that kind of revolution, that kind of rebellion, that kind of self-identification was really a child of the Enlightenment that came out of that ability to reason and see yourself as an important individual. You were not just a cog in the church's machine, or in the king's machine, and so I guess my question to you is, what were the counter elements to that? What are the anti-reason or the anti kind of individual, that we experience today. In other words, Don, I'm coming back to your issue of polarization. What are the two conflicting sides here, in the broadest sense, maybe in this Enlightenment sense? We saw ourselves as children of the Enlightenment. Who is the other side, and what do they see? Or is it all a conflicting mix within the Enlightenment tradition?
I think it's interesting that in the 60s we began to see, or there's sort of two takes on it in some ways in terms of these what we might call student revolutions. But on the one hand, we could make an argument, and some do make an argument, that it was part of this project of Enlightenment, the project of modernity, which is sort of dialectical and it moves back and forth, and that these student protests in the 60s were really sort of part of that dialectical process. Others have sort of read it as a reaction to and against the project of Enlightenment, that the very notion of the project of Enlightenment or the project of modernity had not, in fact, led to some utopian state as it had promised, right? You know, the very project of modernity was sort of grounded on the separation of different fields of knowledge, and so each one would perfect itself and then eventually would sort of come back all together to form some utopian society. And I think there was a great sense amongst a number of students and minority groups in the 1960s that the project of Enlightenment, the project of modernity, had in fact not really led to any of those things, that things were not really improving, that we could look at events, you know, such as the Holocaust in terms of putting nature to order, or, you know, the dropping of the bomb in terms of the development of science and things like that, and really began to perhaps question the very project of the Enlightenment, and suggest that that project of Enlightenment, because it was born entirely out of white Western European societies, was fundamentally problematic and limited a number of other voices that were, as Don mentioned, sort of beginning to grow in size and in volume in terms of sort of asserting their voices. And so, you know, I think in some ways that, again, that sort of tension that we really saw coming forth in the 1960s is really playing out on a broader scale these days. I think it's an interesting thing to sort of add that so many of the ideas about liberty and freedom of speech emerged out of the French Revolution, and yet many of the ideas that emerged that sort of opposed the project of the Enlightenment also came out of a later French tradition of thinkers like Jacques Derrida or Michel Foucault, who were really sort of calling the very project of Enlightenment into question.
Well, in terms of the kind of explosion that took place, one of the things I think that did occur, it was this questioning of authority. And it's not a particularly new idea, but this idea that there was a disillusionment, at least in the United States, with authority, whether it was corporate, whether it was governmental. Corporate, obviously, for instance, the environmental issues, for example, or whether it was governmental in terms of the war, what we were told, what we were not told. So it was a whole set of questioning, I think, coming out of that period of authority and whether or not what was claimed to be true was really true, even if it came out of, for instance, scientific studies. Mm-hmm. You know, we see a lot of this today where we said centered around, for instance, autism. Right. Mm-hmm. There's a whole group of people who say, no, you know, we think it's linked to some kind of problem with young kids. The original study that has been touted has been debunked, that's disappeared, but that still lingers on. And I think part of it is to do with the fact that there is a serious question that grew out, I think, of the 1960s of authority. And then so suddenly that instead of us deferring to an organization such as the government or corporation, we defer to ourselves. We can make our own judgments, and we may not be qualified to make our own judgments, but nonetheless, we will make them anyway. And I think a lot of what occurred in the 1960s was a push back on the acceptance of authority as being the final word or the right word, because people felt a certain betrayal, particularly coming out of that period. And I think that lingers on to this day. I mean, whether it's a left or right, for that matter, there you can find any piece of the spectrum, this idea that we don't trust authority, that we're going to say, trust our own judgments, our own reasoning, and whether or not it leads us in a bad direction or not, I'm not sure. But I think that was the thing. In some ways, I would suggest, if I use that analysis, that the Enlightenment was exactly that. It was a pushback against authority. In that case, it was the church and divine kings. In the 1960s, we get a pushback from authority when it comes to the government or corporate entities or even scientific entities. I mean, I don't know if that's a particularly good analogy, but yeah. I'm just sort of throwing in that as I think about it.
Well, I think it's a very important point you make, because authority, if I understand the Enlightenment correctly, the sense of authority was not so much a wanting to get rid of authority, but the placement of authority and who determines what the authority should be. And so instead of the authority of the church or the priest, the central authority of the king or the sovereign, the sense that led to democracy was that sense that the authority rests in the collective of the people, and that people have, as reasoning, I keep coming back to reasoning as one of the ideals of the Enlightenment, come back to the sense of reason that individuals collectively have the ability to select the authority that they want to guide them, because they can then, as a collective of individuals, they can change that authority. If they don't like what the authority is doing, then through a vote, through their reasoning and argument, they can change the authority. And I want to broaden the sense of again of free speech to another ideal, at least of the Enlightenment for today, which is the ability of science to question, to look, to discover, to build, because that to me seems to be an aspect of free speech as well. The ability of science to question what the church says, to question what the sovereign says. And Pinker argues that it's the increase in science, and I'm again saying that's an aspect of free speech. It is science that moves a people forward, that has moved our democracy forward, that has moved the world, he argues, to actually a better place.
I mean, I think it's a tricky thing. You know, when we think about science, there's sort of an ideal notion of science that it is free from ideology or beliefs, that it's a pure endeavor in that way. And so, you know, if we think of it in that way, we certainly can connect, you know, this notion of freedom of inquiry to freedom of speech. It gets complicated. And again, I think this is one of the things that was really sort of emerging in the 1960s in a lot of these movements, was the questioning of, is science really free from ideology in that way? Is science, you know, an enterprise, or is it still informed by certain beliefs, and that certain kinds of scientists seek information to prove those beliefs true? You know, and I think this is all the more complicated now when we recognize that scientific research is funded by large corporations very often. And so the notion of total free inquiry Even in the sciences, I think is a bit complicated. That if you want to, you know, scientifically investigate something that's not going to get funded, you're not going to be able to do it. You know, this is not the era of sort of an individual just running off and doing science. In some ways, we think about the importance of labs and all these sorts of things. You know, and so there is, I think, even a complication amongst science and the, you know, another sort of complication is that we often are confronted with certain scientific discoveries that really disrupt our very sense of being in some ways. I mean, I think if we think about climate change, you know, a lot of people seem to resist that scientific notion based on religious grounds of, no, God made the earth and he made it this way and that's how it's supposed to be. So anything that happens is all part of God's will. And so they sort of reject the notion that human beings have in any way contributed to terrible things that are going on the planet. And so even science is sort of in one of these sort of hotly contested sort of areas. And I think we're sort of seeing a real inquiry into what science or what certain individuals at least believe science is allowed to look into.
Well, the other thing I think I'm reminded of this sort of this conflict that we often talk in philosophy about this is sort of this empirical concept in which we test the outside world as opposed to a belief. And I think those two come into conflict. So, for instance, you may have a belief that, for instance, that the world is a certain way, say, ecologically. Mm-hmm. And when somebody comes along and says, well, no, the climate's changing. Here's the science to prove it. The belief then begins to trump the scientific evidence. Right. I think that's the case. And then that leads to, I think, to something that in some ways I saw somewhat close up, which is then the manipulation, not of design, manipulation of beliefs. Mm-hmm. So that you sit and say in Washington and you create a whole set of words and you test them out, you know, with focus groups. So what words tell us, you know, what best response, you know, we can get from a particular group. So we talk about tax reform, maybe not tax cuts,
right.
as an example, right?
Right.
I mean, we have just the recent tax cut bill that went through Congress. Republicans will talk about it as tax reform. Those who don't like it will say, no, they're tax cuts, right? So you they look at this terminology and you become – and you put these words out there which appeal to people's individual preconceived beliefs. And I think that's where you begin to get to this sort of manipulation that takes place in this marketplace, as it were, of free speech, right? So now you're not really debating ideas anymore. Now you're pushing beliefs and persuasion, right? And I think that the most interesting thing we may get into later is that, so what does that mean in terms of a marketplace that is overwhelmed by one set of ideas, right? The classic one I was thinking about this morning was talk radio. Talk radio is now predominantly conservative, right? Because we got rid of the fairness doctrine. And that was a response to the economic marketplace, okay? So that means that if you listen to most talk radio, you're not getting a marketplace of ideas, but rather a one set of ideas. And I think, and if you then step back into other forums, you get you continue to get that kind of pushback in one way or another. So, for example, I know that there's concern about, for instance, the ownership by Sinclair mm-hmm. of its television stations, and it forced the local anchors to read a particular thing. There's a particular commentator who is clearly identified with the Trump administration. He does his little thing. So the question becomes if they own 70% of the local stations, for example, I don't think that's what they do, but let's say they own it, then there's a way to pump a particular side of the conversation into the body politic, and you're not really having an exchange of ideas anymore. You're actually pushing out ideas. And I think sort of like, I guess, yeah, maybe we should have an antitrust law, right? I think that's the thing that I think you have to really kind of like think about is – are they being flooded out? Are ideas being flooded out by economic interests or political interests? And if that's the case, we can talk about free speech all we want, but the battlefield is over. They, you know, somebody just won, you know, one side or another.
Well, if what you're saying though is that money becomes the sovereign that dictates,
and I think it always has been in
many
ways.
What is said?
Right?
No, go ahead.
Yeah, if you think back, for instance. you know, it used to be, right, when founders of the country this week, okay, well, it was a printing press, okay? So you had, you know, and if you put out some kind of newspaper, you had to own a printing press, you had to hire people to do it. I mean, it was a very expensive process, right? And they were like the gatekeepers, right? And we get sort of objective journalism, as it were, you know, as they try to expand their audience and so on and so forth. Whereas now you don't need a printing press. You just go online and you got, you know, instant whatever it is. And it might, you don't even have to do a lot of research or whatever it is. So that suddenly you get this situation where this whole business about flooding the information age, then you get to say, okay, well, how do we do it? And one of the things I think that happens, and one of the things that's really interesting, particularly in terms of the Russian intervention into the election, is how much of an impact did all these anonymous trolls, right, have on the election? Because now it's like, did they have a big impact, a small impact? Or what about other groups that are able to flood this information flow? And even on a personal basis, right? I mean, it's individualized, and a lot of people only connect to the people who agree with them. I mean, and so you get this spiraling thing where even in a thing that's so individualized as, say, social media, you can get a manipulation. And we saw, of course, you know, Cambridge Analytics and the whole idea about, well, and then they scoop up all the information so they can then create a message, appeal to you in your particular terms so that they can persuade you. So it's not, so the public, it has now becomes a public mind in which you massage certain portions of the mind itself. I mean, I don't want to sound too dark, but
no. I mean, I think you're right, though.
Your point is well taken, though, and and in fact, it is a little scary, but it's well taken. But literature has played with these mind control, and you're talking about a little sense of psychological control or of mind control through the media. But literature has played with this idea of mind control. And say something about that, Adam,
well,
if you would.
Yeah, I mean, I think literature occupies a peculiar space in all this. On the one hand, you know, the literary text has a certain, ideally at least, a certain freedom from restriction of speech that is different from other platforms, right? Particularly if we put something in a fictionalized context that perhaps literature is at the forefront of pushing boundaries of speech and acceptability and even notions of what is offensive or not. At the same time, I think literature has also been very quick to make commentary about limitations of speech and investigation and inquiry and all these kind of things. I mean, I go back again to 1984. Which, you know, we still have this sort of state authority there. To go back to something that Don mentioned, that there is also economic pressure in that sort of way. Again, this still comes into play with literature, though, that if writers want to have their works read widely and make money off them, and whether writers want to admit it or not, they all do at a certain level, they are in many ways limited by the market. And we can call that a certain level of self-censorship. But again, I think it's difficult to say that it's only self-censorship when there is, in essence, an economic threat. I mean, I go back to what you'd mentioned about the Sinclair News Group, that yes, technically any number of those journalists did have the right to free speech to say, no, I will not read this on air. This is a violation of journalistic integrity or whatever it is. But I don't think any of them did. And the reality was that you will read this or you will lose your job. Does that become a form of compelled speech, which is a violation of free speech? Right. And again, some, you know, the sort of notion of asserting one's own individual will, again, sounds wonderful in a sort of an ideal sense. But is that ever really possible? Are there always sort of constraints? Right. We're not threatened to be burned at the stake for calling the church into question these days, but we are threatened with pretty severe financial recourse for certain expressions of free speech. I think I'm blanking on her name, but I think about the woman who was fired from her job for flipping off the Trump motorcade,
right,
which you know, a lot of people, I think, sort of chuckled at that case early on, but it really does become a very interesting question. You know, she was not threatening the motorcade. She was not calling for violence against the motorcade. She simply expressed herself with, you know, her one-finger vote, as they say. But the repercussions for her were very, very real. And again, there are very compelling arguments to be made that that's a very dangerous sort of path to go down to.
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, the corporate, and not just corporate, any business for that matter, right? You know, one of the things, and Adam and I were talking about this off mic, is this idea that you know, when we walk around, we represent our institutions, whether it's at Salisbury University or it's Delmarva Public Radio. We're sort of semi-public, right? So I may think something, but I may not necessarily say it in public. I may say it to a friend, because if I say in public, I'm representing the company, right, as opposed to my own personal view. And I think as you move down the chain from public people to sort of semi-private people, in the sense of working for a company where you may very well not, you know, be very public to be out there in terms of the public, you could find yourself, as the woman was, she happened to be caught on camera doing this, right? But you, if you're sitting at a bar and you say something and it gets back to the boss and the boss doesn't like it, then he has that economic power to penalize you in some fashion. Generally speaking, if you say something, it's got to get out into the ether. I mean, generally speaking, it's got to be more public than that before somebody will act on it. But nonetheless, it's that I think that those restraints are there.
No, I mean, I think you really key on something very important there, that any discussions about free speech, we always have to sort of consider the speaker and the audience at the same time. You know, an individual sitting at home by themselves can say whatever they want and have no repercussions whatsoever. When you move out into the sort of public realm, or at least some of these different public realms, then we do begin to see, again, repercussions that can come into play either, again, socially, right, sort of people just responding to something that they find offensive that you say, or professionally, right, which, again, is part, if we think about the social, that is part of the very notion of debate that was grounded in the Enlightenment, right, that we arrive at the best ideas by debating different ideas. But again, that was sort of one of the difficulties of if someone expresses a particular political belief that is different than their boss's political belief and they're punished for it, is that a violation of the law? Is it a violation of the protection of free speech in that way? And again, obviously, it depends on what is said, right, the extremity right. of what is said. But it's one of these sort of very instead of there being black and white poles to it with a little bit of gray in the middle, it seems as if it's all gray. And that becomes the really tough thing, I think, that's being worked out ideally in some ways right now.
Well, I would suggest that just quickly that it's actually always been there.
Right.
Only, you know, if you were in the village, you didn't necessarily say everything because you got some immediate repercussions. Now we just see it on a very large scale. Anonymity is probably the best haven for free speech.
Right. We live in a very messy world, and we have to accommodate, frankly, to that messy world. And there is such a thing in human psychology and in human reasoning called discretion. And we can call on our discretion. And there's also such a thing, I believe, as editing our thoughts. And we don't need to say everything. And as someone who's been married for over 50 years now, I can attest to the value of being able to edit your thoughts and using discretion. Let me take a little broader view here. We have a few minutes left. Jimmy Carter, in a recent Sunday school class, is reported in a piece by Margaret Wrinkle in the New York Times to have said to the class she attended, "We have lost faith in a lot of things that have always nurtured us," he said. "Many people in the world have lost faith in democracy. We've lost faith in the sanctity of telling the truth and the value of education. We've lost faith in the equality of people. In our country's history, some of our greatest struggles have been over the sense of equality. He went on to ask the audience there when women got the right to vote. And a person in the audience raised her hand and said 1920. And Carter added, for white women. Hmm. And clear, you know, we think tribally, unfortunately, we think on it. But let me ask you, we've lost faith in the sanctity of the truth, the value of education, and so forth. Do you think Carter's right here? Where are we with, to be very blunt about it, in the current circumstances where we appear to be going backward from the Enlightenment, as using that again as our benchmark? Is Carter right?
I think we're too close to the storm yet to know whether it's going to pass or not. My gut says it will. Maybe that's more hope than gut. I don't know. But American democracy has always been kind of raucous and screaming at people again. I mean, to settle the issue of slavery, we killed 600,000 Americans. I mean, that's so compared to that kind of crisis, which was really almost existential in terms of the nation. We're far from that. I tend to think that while we certainly often act on our beliefs and we can be manipulated, as I think we often have, I think the future we will get past this. I mean, I'm reaching for normalcy, but and the whole idea that not only can you spin a particular story, a particular thing, but now you can lie about it.
Right.
You can say that black is white and white is black. I mean, that's the level I think that we've seen in terms certainly of political discourse as I've watched it. But I think in the end, there's a lot of countervailing forces that push back against that. You know, whether it's journalists, whether it's people publishing books, whether it's people going on the radio, whether it's or television, whether they protest. I think there's a lot of pushback against the idea that there is no such thing as truth, that but you can do anything you want, that we don't really believe in the equality of people. I think that I think the denunciation, for instance, of the alt-right and its particular view of separation of races, whether you think one should be superior or not, beside the issue. That sort of thing. I mean, that's not getting, in terms of equality, that's not getting traction.
Right.
And as I look back over the history of the United States, I see a country that was clearly flawed when it came to equality, for the obvious reasons of slavery, et cetera. And over this march of time, we have created a society that's far more equal and far more diverse, with far more opportunities than ever in its history. And I think that's grounded in its fundamental creeds of equality, which the founders they agonized over, because they knew on the one hand they talked about all people being equal, on the other hand they knew there was slavery. When they moved west, people agonized over the fact that they were going to push Native Americans out of the way, right? So they created the concept of Empire of Liberty, which for whom, right?
Right.
But they were always there, and we're constantly, I think, pushing in the right direction. So I'm not as pessimistic as Carter's. I think we will get through it. I think there are mechanisms that'll push us in the right direction. I don't know about when you think, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it's. I think there is a shaking of belief in rationality and progress and truth in certain segments of the culture in America. Again, going back to this notion that some people assert that the very project of the Enlightenment was white, European, and racist in its inception, and therefore what has come out of it is therefore problematic and should be done away with. I think one of the other complications that you sort of hint at, but is really sort of coming to the forefront, is the immediacy of information now, where I can't remember where I was watching this, but there was a young man who was being interviewed and was sort of being asked about race relations in America. I don't remember the exact question, but he responded that things are worse now than they ever have been. And sort of thinking about the sort of larger American project that you're talking about, there's just something absurd about that notion that things are worse today than they ever have been. But at the same time, I think with the proliferation of news stories that sort of heighten our sense of things, you know, can we say that race relations are in a rougher place than they were a year and a half ago? I think we can make an argument that there's at least greater tensions. But so, you know, I think because of the immediacy, the sort of longer view of history is something that's sort of being lost, right? With this grand sense of a loss of historicity, where the focus on the right now really becomes troubling in terms of thinking about a longer project that we are still in sort of growing pains for, that we are perhaps ideally working towards something better. And if you don't believe that we're working towards something better, this is where this pessimism arises. And again, I don't know that I would say that it's an American condition right now, but that there are certainly segments on both sides of the political spectrum that really seem to be pushing for a radical change that moves away from the sort of foundational notions of democracy that the nation is ostensibly grounded in.
I'm not sure I agree that it's moving away from democracy yet. Right. I mean, I think that's there. I mean, I think in the end, I think people say, yes, we're going to run out and vote, right? I mean, I think that's true, and I think that you're right. I think that the immediacy of the issue at hand, whether say for instance Black Lives Matter, for example, right. Police brutality. Well, of course, we all know that really police brutality, particularly towards African Americans, has actually been going on for a very long time.
Of course.
We just happen to notice right. it. But for somebody who's living in the here and now, which I mean, most people are not historians,
right.
Okay, that it seems like it's worse. And my observation has always been, well, it seems worse because those elements within society, racist elements inside, they're just surfacing.
Right.
You know before Barack Obama's presidency, well, maybe they were latent,
right.
And then his presidency brought many of those out, and you get the production of the alt-right. So, yeah, and the same thing, you know, when you get conservatives who don't like the changes, whether it's gay marriage or whatever it is, and so they're pushing back. So I mean, you get this struggle. And I think in the end, I think we will be okay as any nation state will is right.
And that struggle is
yeah.
part of that very project of enlightenment.
Exactly, and it's very very hard. It doesn't come pain free.
No, it never does.
let me suggest that Pinker again argues in his book Enlightenment Now, which I highly, highly recommend. Pinker argues that things are getting better, not because there is an inherent movement in history and in the nature of the world to get better. In fact, it's the opposite. He says that the big enemies we have are entropy and evolution. Evolution because things are trying to eat us all the time,
sure.
As they try to survive, and entropy because in a closed system, things come apart, and that's kind of the nature of the way. So we need energy to keep going. What he says is, though, that things are getting better because through reason, through science, his ideals of the Enlightenment, he argues, things are getting better because human beings are making them better. Through science, medicine is much, much better. Through reason, we now have a sense of our value as individuals and so forth. So let me begin to wrap up with Pinker's argument. And he uses statistics. So he takes the broader view, not segregation or integration in the United States, takes a global view, statistics on health, wealth, knowledge, safety, and other indicators of things better or worse. And Pinker says since the Enlightenment unfolded, and he argues the 18th century, he says life expectancy has risen from 30 years to 71. And remember, we're looking at the mid 1700s here. So it's not a terribly long time. And in the more fortunate countries, life expectancy is 81 now instead of 30. He says that when the Enlightenment began, a third of the children born in the richest parts of the world died before their fifth birthday. Today, that fate befalls 6% of the children in the poorest parts of the world. And then he argues on with those kind of statistics on wealth, knowledge, safety, and so forth for 400 pages.
Okay.
And that leads him to say in the opening story that I read, the story of human progress is truly heroic. And what he suggests is that not because it just is, but it's because as human beings, we have embraced the ideals of the Enlightenment. And even though it's a mixed bag, we know that, and Adam, you clarified that, because of those ideals of science and reason and humanism and progress that we are better. Don and Adam, thank you both very much for what I believe is a really exciting discussion. And I'm looking forward to our next discussion on the internet and what that is doing to us and free speech in the world of the internet. And thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.